You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a sports writer who will give us a preview of the 2018 Milwaukee Brewers season. Right now, bringing down prescription drug costs continues to be a priority for many lawmakers, especially after drastic price increases for generic medications that a lot of people rely on. Those spikes, which many say amount to price gouging, can make drugs unaffordable for the people who need them. A new bill in Wisconsin looks to fight price gouging through the state's Department of Justice. The Democratic bill would give the Attorney General more power to discourage price increases by pharmaceutical companies. Senator Dave Hansen is an author of the bill. He's a Democrat representing the state's 30th Senate District in the Green Bay area. Senator Hansen, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's great to be on, and I also wanted to mention that Jimmy Anderson from Fitchburg is the Assembly author. We had a great press conference last week with Dr. Nikki Marikas, and who feels the price gouging is hurting her patients, and a young lady, Courtney Waller, spoke about how her daughter's health is threatened and basically even her life because of the increases in generic and off-patient drugs.
Let's follow up on that before we get to the details of the bill. What problems are you seeing when it comes to increases in these prescription drug costs?
Well, a 2016 GAO report, the Government Accountability Office, pretty reliable, found that one in five generic drugs had an extraordinary price increase of at least 100%. 48 generic drugs had price increases by 500%, and 12 generic drugs had price hikes over 1,000%. And these are drugs we're talking about, Albuterol for asthma medication went up tremendous amount, 4,000%. Doxycycline, a medication for bacterial infections, spiked 8,281%. And Pravastatin for heart conditions jumped 573%. To me, this is just not acceptable. We want to give the authority to the Attorney General to say, hey, let's look at this price gouging. In the end, it's going to kill people. We've got to do what we can to make these more affordable. The whole idea of off-patent and generic drugs was to control costs. And now you have some pharmaceutical companies, and there are a lot of good ones out there, but these bad ones are really taking advantage of the situation, and they're doing it basically because they can.
As I understand it, in most of these cases, there's only one company producing a particular medication, and either they raise the prices or they get bought out, and then the new company raises the prices. Is that right?
Right. I think there is no competition, and as a result, these life-saving drugs are being manipulated by, you know, people that are doing this in an unscrupulous way and predatory way, and it is a sad situation. Like I said, Ms. Waller that spoke, you know, the disease is Timothy's disease, and without these lower-priced generic drugs, she will not survive. She has no cure for this disease, and she just needs to have reasonable pricing. And if there is a reason for prices to go up, that's included in the whole plan for the Attorney General to keep that in mind. So we're not accusing all pharmaceutical companies of doing this, but the ones that are really abusing the situation, and they're hurting a lot of people.
Talking to State Senator Dave Hansen, co-author of a bill that would give the Attorney General some powers to try to keep prescription drug prices from going up at rapid rates. And let's get into Senator Hansen and what this legislation does. What powers does it give to the Attorney General?
The Attorney General would have the authority, and first of all, he could request a manufacturer to submit a statement within 45 days that, and this is what the details are, itemizes components of the cost of producing the drug, identifies the circumstances, the timing of any increase in material or manufacturing costs, identifies the circumstances and timing of any expenditures made to expand access to the drug, any other info deemed relevant by the manufacturer. In other words, to prove that these drug price increases are necessary, and if they're not, then the Attorney General's got to step in and stop the price gouging or compel a corporation to justify these large rate increases. So basically, that's what we're trying to do. We want a committee hearing on this bill, and we hope to pursue this issue in the 2018 Attorney General campaign if Attorney General Schimmel doesn't want to act on this.
Have you heard from Attorney General Schimmel? Have you consulted with him on the idea of giving him this power?
Well, we had a lot of press last week, and we have heard nothing yet. Of course, we want to bring the bill forward. We would like to get his support, so maybe that's the next step to see. I know Maryland has done this, so that's a state where they've been successful in making sure that no patient will be denied these critical medications because they're too expensive. So they can do it. Wisconsin can do it. We just have to have the will. And we will be working with Attorney General Schimmel if he will react to this. We haven't had much success dealing with high cost of pharmaceutical prices and holding the manufacturers actually accountable. So we've got hope, and if not now, maybe in the next session. But I think this is something that's totally getting out of control, and people aren't going to survive because of it.
Now, people might say, okay, yeah, the market isn't working right now to keep these prices down. But eventually, if the prices are that high, another company will come into the market, and this problem will solve itself in the long run. We don't need the state coming in and setting market conditions for drugs. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say that 4,000% increases or 8,000% increases or even pravastatin for heart conditions jumping 573%. As I said before, the whole idea of generic or off-patent patent drugs was to control the cost so people wouldn't be priced out of the marketplace to buy these products. And now, you know, they go off-market, and they're still using a situation where they can do it, but they're hurting a lot of people, and we got to try to stop it without a doubt.
Now, you authored this, as you said, with a Democratic colleague in the Assembly. Republicans have the majority in both chambers. Have you heard anything about possible bipartisan support for this idea?
Our goal always is to get bipartisan support, but this bill really does make a lot of sense. It should become law, and we should get these unscrupulous companies that are charging or overcharging because they can. We've got to stop them. So whatever we got to do, if we can get a public hearing and maybe the Attorney General can be there to speak to it, that'd be great. If not, we're going to keep pushing this, and maybe it will be an issue going forward in November of 2018 in the AG race, because this really does make sense.
This idea of the companies having to justify their price increase, it seems like there could be some gray area in that. They could fiddle with the accounting a little bit and justify just about any kind of price increase. Do you worry that that would lead to just, you know, getting bogged down in the legal system then?
Well, I'm just saying that there's no reason for them to be increasing these high percentages. As the doctor said, it's hurting her patients. I mean, when this drug goes generic or off patent, the whole idea was that was going to control the cost. And, you know, they can make up excuses, but if you really look at it, they're going to have to prove that what they're doing, you know, the manufacturing of it or whatever I had mentioned before, all the other issues, they're going to have to prove it. You know, any other info deemed relevant by the manufacturer, they're not just going to say, okay, we're going to raise it 8,000% or 500%. We're going to have to prove that the cost has gone up that much, and we have a right to do this. And we've seen some other incidents of people abusing the pharmaceutical interest. And it, to me, we just have to do whatever we can to make it work for people in this state. And eventually in this country, pharmaceutical companies are taking over. You know, we had the opportunity back in the early 2000s to produce a plan called the Senior Care, where we work together in a bipartisan way, where we provide low-cost drugs for our seniors. The only state in the union that does that. We did that in a bipartisan way. And as I mentioned at the press conference, I'd like to see this happen in a bipartisan way, because this is about making a difference in people's lives.
Are you hoping to see some action at the federal level on these issues?
We always are. I mean, if they can do it. But right now they're bogged down with a lot of other stuff. And, you know, there's certain things that just have to happen to treat people well. And I think, you know, when we're talking about the co-op that puts this on, Healthcare for All, I think it really is what we have to be looking at. We have to provide affordable health care for more people in our state, in our country. And one of the biggest keys is controlling the cost of pharmaceutical products, because they just are outrageous. And the ones that I've mentioned, approved by the Government Accountability Office, they are way, way out of whack, and they should be controlled. If they have a reason for doing it, it makes sense. You know, we can litigate it, but the Attorney General sure as heck can figure it out that those large increases just are not reasonable.
And Senator Hansen, as we wrap up, the legislative session is all but over right now. Are you hoping that it's still this still gets a committee hearing during this current session?
We always keep hope. We will be in session on March 20th. Supposed to be the wrap-up day for us to take up 260 bills. But I would like to see us try to follow through on this if we have to work on it this summer, this fall, and hopefully in next session if we can move it now, because this is something that has to be dealt with before we lose more and more people that just can't afford off patent or generic drugs. It just does not make any sense that companies are getting away with this.
Senator Hansen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us. And remember, this is just an essential issue for the future of the people in the state.
Senator Dave Hansen is a Democrat representing the state's 30th Senate district, including Green Bay. He's the author, co-author of a new bill that would give the state's attorney general more power to contest price increases for generic prescription drugs. First, after hiring a new general manager in David Stearns and committing to a roster rebuild a couple years back, the Milwaukee Brewers are looking to compete for a playoff spot this year after playing well above expectations in 2017. Spring training is now in full swing, and our next guest is there in Phoenix. Tom Hodricourt joins us for a preview of the Brewers season. He's a sports writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
The Brewers last year didn't make the playoffs, but they came a heck of a lot closer, I think, than anybody expected. Are we getting a sense of optimism about the Brewers' 2018 season?
I don't think there's any question about that, Rob. Both internally and out in the baseball world in general, I think the Brewers elevated their status a lot last year. As you noted, they weren't expected to do a lot. They won 86 games. That was in the second full season of a large-scale rebuilding plan, and you generally don't get there that quickly. So it got the Brewers' management's attention. Mark Attanasio, the owner, and general manager David Stearns, and they went out and made a couple of very eye-catching moves when they acquired outfielders Christian Yelich and Lorenzo Cain. So now they appear to have an even more potent team, especially offensively.
Yeah, let's talk about those two new acquisitions in the outfield. How much of a difference maker could they be?
Well, I think a lot. Yelich and Cain are known as two of the better all-around players in baseball, all-around outfielders for sure. They're very good defenders, and a lot of people don't realize that when you improve your defense, especially significantly, it helps your pitching. Your pitching becomes better because these guys catch balls that other players don't get to. But then they're also very high on-base percentage guys, and the Brewers have been kind of a swing-and-miss team the last couple of years, and that's kind of the way the game in general is going now. There's a lot of home runs hit, a lot of strikeouts. The Brewers, in fact, set the Major League record for strikeouts each of the last 2 years, so that's not a record you want to keep breaking. And so Cain and Yelich are way better at getting on base, and that should improve their offense.
And then speaking of outfield, there's a fellow named Ryan Braun who usually plays out there. I understand because of these new folks, he's trying out at first base in spring training. Is that right?
He is. He told us the other day that he's not even, quote, remotely comfortable there yet. And that would be expected. I think people in general, and Rob, maybe you hear this just in baseball discussions, think that anybody can play first base. You know, it's kind of considered where you put the fat kid in Little League or whatever you want to say. You know, everybody thinks you can play first base. But there's a lot of nuances to it. And especially in this modern era of defensive shifting where the first baseman will be positioned far, far off the bag and have to really hustle to get back over there on a ground ball, there's a lot more to it. And Ryan Braun would be the first to tell you. You know, he's played the outfield for a decade now. And so we'll see if that is something that carries over to the season to any significant extent. Otherwise, we can't wait to see how they're going to get all these outfielders playing time, because the three starting outfielders from last year, Ryan Braun in left and Keon Broxton in center and Domingo Santana in right, are all back and still on the team. So now you add Yelich and Cain. You know, this isn't men's softball. You don't get to use a rover out there. you get three guys. And so, I've yet to hear a manager complain, I've got too many good players, please stop giving me so many good players. But Craig Counsell is going to have to find at bats for all these guys, unless they trade some away or somebody gets hurt.
Let's switch to pitching now. I understand that the Brewers haven't made a big splash, a big pickup in the starting pitching rotation.
They have not. I know that's discouraged some of their fans. There were a couple of big names out there this winter. Yu Darvish, who went to the Cubs. That made Brewers fans even crazier, because not only did they not get him, the dreaded Cubs got him. You know? So that made a few heads spin off into orbit. And then Jake Arrieta, who just recently signed with the Phillies. But the people need to understand the restraints the Brewers have in their market size. They're in the, depending on who you listen to, either the smallest market in baseball or the second smallest. And so they do have to watch their payroll. The Cubs will operate probably with a payroll around 170 or 180 this year, and the Brewers will be half that. So they can't just spend willy-nilly on pitchers, especially older ones who might not see the back end of the contracts and still be productive. So they have an unfailing belief in their ability to make the guys they have better than they used to be. And we saw that dramatically last year with three pitchers, Chase Anderson, Zach Davies, and Jimmy Nelson. They all were better than they were the year before, and pitching coach Derek Johnson has a lot to do with that. Now, Jimmy Nelson's injured. He hurt his shoulder late last year. He had surgery. We don't know when he's coming back. Maybe not till midseason. And that does hurt the Brewers. He was one of their best pitchers last year. He had almost 200 strikeouts when he got hurt. And so they're hoping he can come back by midseason and then also be, nearly as good as he was in the past. If he does, that'll be like trading for a pitcher at midseason.
Tom Hodricourt's with us, sports writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're previewing the Milwaukee Brewers season. Tom, before we leave free agency, it's been kind of a weird year. Some people still on the table, some people signing shorter contracts than usual. Could the Brewers go bargain hunting still?
Well, there's a couple of guys out there. Alex Cobb, who has pitched in the past for Tampa Bay, but I think he's still looking for more money than the Brewers want to spend on him. So, well, we'll see. As you said, it's been a very, very odd offseason. It's maybe a watershed moment that we're going to look back on in future years about when the game's economics changed a little bit, because teams just look really hesitant now to spend a lot of money on older players, and the Players Union is not pleased about that. And but there's no new collective bargaining agreement for four more years, so the union's just going to have to put up with it, and they're not pleased that the salaries have gone down for some of their higher experienced players. So we'll see if this was the year that the economics turned for good, or if it was just an abnormal offseason. We do have guys like Bryce Harper and Manny Machado coming on the market next winter, and they're considered two of the top players in baseball. If they don't get any offers, then things have changed for good. So. Well, we won't know until we move forward, but as you noted, this has been one strange offseason for free agents.
Now, Tom, it's been a long time since I've been to a spring training, a really long time, and a lot of people may never get there. Can you set the scene for us, for baseball fans, just what it's like to be at spring training?
It's very relaxed. The games don't count, there's not a lot of pressure on the teams. Early on in spring training, you don't see the regular players play very much because they're working their way towards being ready for the season, and they don't want to leave it all down here. They play over 30 games. It's a long exhibition season. So you add that to the 162-game regular season, and you're talking 200 games before you even think about the playoffs. So it's more relaxed. You're sitting in the sun, wearing shorts and T-shirts. I'm sure the grass looks greener. The beer tastes colder. You get a little closer look at the players, too. You can get a little closer to them, get their autographs. So I know a lot of people enjoy it. It's kind of a relaxed atmosphere. And I'm not going to kid you. I miss six of the most horrid weeks of winter because they're the last weeks of winter, and everybody's tired of it, right, Rob? I'm sure you can echo that sentiment, right?
Nice work if you can get it, Tom.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. I don't sit by the pool drinking pina coladas like a lot of people think I do, but I'm watching baseball. I'm covering baseball for a living, and for 6 weeks I'm out of the frozen tundra, so not going to hear a whole lot of complaints about that.
And, Tom, it's fun for the reporters, the guys who have jobs locked down. It's a little more relaxed for them. But I imagine there's a lot of guys kind of on the cusp who are, they're fighting for their job here. This is their chance to prove something.
Yeah, and the Brewers didn't have that many job openings at the start of this camp because they did so well last year, as we noted earlier in the program, that there just wasn't that many new jobs. A lot of these guys are still in the club. So, you know, you have for the guys that are on the cusp, but they've got a lot at stake. And then beyond that, Rob, there's the young players who know they're not going to make the team this spring, but who would like to be considered in the future, and they want to leave an impression too. So those players get after it. The guys with jobs can be relaxed, you know, get in shape, work their way in slowly. The other guys go out there and get after it every day. And so you start with like 55 to 60 players in camp, and you're only going to keep 25. So there's a whole lot of guys there trying to fight for their future. So there are different agendas going on out there for players depending on their experience level. And that's what makes camp interesting. We've had guys like G-Man Choi, a South Korean player who is new to the organization, hit a bunch of home runs this spring and, you know, really open eyes. And then last year's Brewers' number one draft pick, Keston Hira, who was in college this time a year ago, he's been tearing it up in spring training. So Brewers fans are all excited about his future with the club. So you get to see a wide variety of players with a wide variety of agendas and hopes and for showing what they can do. So makes it very interesting.
Well, Tom, enjoy the rest of spring training and the weather. Thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Tom Hodricourt, a sports writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us from Arizona for a preview of the Milwaukee Brewers season. Now, Florida lawmakers passed new gun control legislation following the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Lawmakers raised the minimum age to buy rifles from 18 to 21. They also included a ban on bump stocks and instituted a 3-day waiting period for gun purchases. Since then, the National Rifle Association has filed a lawsuit challenging the changes to the law. The organization claims that the new laws are in violation of the Constitution. Our next guest is here to talk about the politics surrounding the lawsuit, the influence of the NRA, and its political future in a country where the conversation surrounding gun control in some ways appears to be changing. Alexandra Falindra is an associate professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Can you talk about the significance of the state of Florida passing these new gun laws, despite the opposition of the NRA?
It clearly suggests that there might be a turning point, that at least after Parkland, there is increased mobilization among young people in the state of Florida, and that has contributed to the pressure that the largely Republican legislators in Florida and its Republican and conservative governor felt to pass certain consensus, I would say, pieces of restrictions on guns. These are not anything that is very radical. It's a compromised legislation that includes some fairly minor provisions given the size of overall gun ownership in the United States and how easy it is to get guns.
Florida Governor Republican Rick Scott has been a supporter of the Second Amendment and gun rights, but he did sign the gun reform package. Here's a little bit about what he said about it.
There's been vigorous debate on all of these issues. I believe every side has had their chance to share their views, and that is truly what makes our democracy great. At the beginning of this process, I said that we should all have to give a little and make compromises, and that includes me. I know that many wanted more gun control than what is included in this bill, and I know that many believe this bill has too much gun control. I respect the sincerity and the validity of both of these viewpoints.
What do you make of how the Republican governor of Florida described these new laws?
Yeah, I mean, he said it is a compromise between what supporters of stricter gun regulations have been asking for and what the NRA and its members are willing to give in. For example, the bump stocks was probably the easiest part in terms of this legislation, given that even the NRA at some point said that it is okay to regulate bump stocks and not allow people to essentially convert military assault rifles into almost automatic weapons.
I want to look at an NRA statement. The NRA is suing Florida, especially over that increase in the age of buying long guns, 18 to 21. Here's a quote from their statement about their lawsuit. Every legislator who voted for this bill violated their sworn oath to support, protect, and defend the Constitution. Then in that statement, they go on to say, hey, maybe we need to vote out people who supported this legislation. Can you talk about the NRA's reaction in the courts and in the political system?
It's definitely far more, it's going to be far more effective in the political, at the political level, and especially as the 2018 elections are approaching, rather than the courts. There have already been several decisions at the federal appeals level that have decided that age restrictions are appropriate under the Second Amendment, and that putting this type of gun control restriction does not constitute a violation of the right to bear arms. And even in the decision, the Heller decision of 2008, which basically determined, if you will, that there is such a thing as an individual right to bear arms, Justice Scalia did carefully specify that that doesn't mean that there isn't a place for reasonable restrictions that the states and localities can place. Now the debate is going to be on what constitutes reasonable restrictions. We have already seen Maryland introducing and passing legislation to ban assault weapons. So we will see in the next few years as these challenges by the NRA percolate through the system, what holds. Clearly, the hope of the NRA, as it was in the case in the past, is to get this to the Supreme Court and have a Supreme Court decision. However, already the Supreme Court has declined to hear cases related to age restrictions, even though over the objections of Clarence Thomas, for example. As far as we can say, these types of restrictions will hold as constitutional.
Talking to Alexandra Falindra from the University of Illinois, Chicago, looking at gun control after the Parkland shooting. And Alexandra, you've said elsewhere that there's kind of an imbalance on the gun debate. While a lot of people, when surveyed, might say they support particular kinds of gun control or expanded background checks, the people who are opposed to those things and the NRA are more fervent, they're more passionate about the issue, and they work better as a political lobbying group. Do you see that starting to change with the student protests?
I would like to say that, but I don't think that there's going to be a radical change. We have seen instances of mobilization for short periods of time after major shootings. It happened after Newtown in 2012. It has happened before. After essentially every major and sensational shooting, and they're getting worse and worse, the public's response to guns spikes. People want more guns, more gun control. And as a result, there is an instance of mobilization, but then the media move on from the issue, and the people move on from the issue. To mobilize people around an issue, it really needs to speak to them on a very deep identity level. It has to mean something to them personally as members of groups. And so far, gun control has been, for people, an issue of costs and benefits. Yes, these costs and benefits are counted in actual lives, but unlike gun rights, which people understand viscerally as something that is important to them as a group and as people, gun control has not reached that level yet. I don't expect that it will be anytime very soon, especially because the messaging around gun control is really not conducive to making it an issue that would activate people's identities and who they are.
Alexandra Flindra is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She's with us to talk about gun laws passed in Florida and a National Rifle Association lawsuit against those laws, all following the Parkland school shooting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of the legislation itself, including raising the minimum age to buy long guns, raising that from 18 to 21, as is the federal limit for handguns right now? What do you think of the NRA's decision to challenge Florida in the courts over this legislation and possibly challenge lawmakers in elections? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the NRA's decision to sue Florida over new gun control legislation that lawmakers passed last week. We're talking to Alexandra Flindra, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the gun control legislation in Florida, of the NRA lawsuit? Do you see the conversation over gun control changing? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Rhinelander. Jim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I think the NRA is completely unreasonable, and I've thought this for a long time. I used to be a member, and they changed like in the late 70s or early 80s. So I said, they're not reasonable anymore. And I think that's what the NRA stands for, not reasonable anymore. And the other thing I want to say is I think we have this wrong with these assault-style looking guns. They are no different than the guns we carry in the deer woods as far as you have a semi-automatic deer rifle that can shoot. I'm sorry, I just came in from the car. That can shoot off rounds just as quickly. What we need to get at is the capacity of how many bullets these guns can hold. I own rifles. I own shotguns. When I hunt ducks, by federal law, I can only have 3 shot shells in my shotgun, and that's to help protect the duck so there isn't overshooting. And I've been saying since the first shooting started, we need to start addressing that sort of thing.
Jim, I'm going to jump in. You can catch your breath, too. Alexandra, he's saying, raising an issue people have been raising about the ammunition capacity of weapons. Is there any movement, state or federal, to put limits on that?
Not one that seems to be going very far. The best thing that has happened is with these bomb stocks, which are basically ways to really convert the rifles into almost automatic style shooting, so you can have really rapid fire because you use these conversion things. But in terms of actually regulating ammunition more closely and not allowing the magazines that take 15 and 20 bullets at a time. So far, none of these state laws, and it's Florida was the first one, but there is action, as you might know, in Illinois. Our governor here just vetoed today a very, very similar legislation, and our state legislature is going to try to override the veto in the next few days. But these bills are not including bans on high-capacity ammunition or anything like that, and it doesn't seem to be part of this type of compromise at this stage.
Jim, thanks for the call. Go next to TJ in Clinton. TJ, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, a couple things. First off, I do agree with the NRA filing a lawsuit. Although we may not agree with the opinion of the NRA, it's nice to know that there's an organization that's always going to at least attempt to try and support the Second Amendment. But my question really revolves around punishment. We hear about these shootings all the time, and we hear that we need more gun control and we need to, you know, restrict the number of bullets or whatever it may be. But have we talked much about what kind of punishment is there for the carelessness of others, mainly parents, allowing children access to these weapons to be able to commit these kinds of crimes?
TJ, thanks for the call. In this case, the Parkland perpetrator apparently was able to buy a gun legally at 18 on his own. But Alexandra, talk about parental responsibility. Is that part of the conversation here?
To the extent that it is possible to, yes, I mean, some people are talking about the role of parents, but it is so easy, even for underage children. We saw that at Columbine. The two shooters at Columbine were underage, but they were able to send a friend of theirs who was of age to a gun show. And given the very, very loose regulations that govern how gun sales are done at gun shows, the kids were able to get high-powered weapons through that process. It is very, very difficult, and it's not fair to put the onus on parents at this stage. A lot of these shooters have been adults. It's not typical that a 15-year-old or a 10-year-old is going to go around with a high-powered rifle and start shooting in a school, though we're starting to see younger kids implicated. More often, younger kids are actually involved in accidents, and we have thousands of even toddlers every year who die or shoot somebody by mistake because of the parents have left weapons unprotected and not secured.
And that's all the time we have. TJ, thanks for calling in. And Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
We've been talking to Alexandra Falindra. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She joined us to talk about the NRA's decision to sue Florida over gun control legislation passed there last week. Congress is expected to take up the next farm bill this spring, and President Donald Trump has proposed major cuts to crop insurance and other safety net programs for farmers. Congress moved in the other direction with a program to protect dairy producers earlier this year, but as Hope Kerwin reports, some Wisconsin farmers say it hasn't protected them from low milk prices, and they're not convinced the changes are going to help.
Dairy analyst Mark Stevenson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison says the Dairy Margin Protection Program, or MPP, is kind of like car insurance.
Producers decide the level of coverage or safety protection that they want, a little bit like thinking about how much deductible would I want on an auto insurance policy.
Drivers pay a premium to cover their expenses in case they get into an accident. With MPP, dairy farmers pay to protect their profit margin, ensuring they'll be able to cover expenses even if the price for milk drops. The program subtracts the average cost of feed from the average price farmers receive for their milk. If that margin falls below their level of coverage, farmers get a check to cover the difference. Milk prices rise and fall every few years, so Stevenson says producers were excited to have some stability when MPP was created in the 2014 Farm Bill. Producers like Jack Erics from Cashton. He says he knew the program wasn't perfect, but he wanted to sign up anyway.
I thought, you know, gosh, maybe they're going to tweak this program and maybe it'll get better and we need to be in it.
He paid the $100 yearly fee to participate and even bought additional coverage for a 600-cow herd. Then milk prices dropped. For Eric's and other farmers, the continued low prices felt like a car accident for their farm. But there was no insurance payout to help them recover. That's because the cost of feed also fell around the same time. So even though farmers were earning almost a third less for their milk than the previous year, MPP's calculations showed they still had a profit margin. Eric says, unfortunately, feed isn't the only cost for farmers.
Labor is a huge expense on a dairy like ours, and this program does nothing to make account for that expense.
Unlike other federal safety net programs, MPP hasn't sent out regular payments to producers, even though major commodity prices have been down over the last 3 years. A 2017 report from the Congressional Research Service found premium payments from farmers exceeded the amount MPP has paid out. Only producers at the highest level of coverage have gotten help from the program. By comparison, crop insurance and other safety net programs for corn producers have paid out around $5 billion each year. Stevenson, the UW-Madison analyst, says it's pretty obvious the MPP formula hasn't been working.
Congress did not intend this to be an income stream for the U.S. Treasury.
And lawmakers have done something to fix it. In the federal budget deal passed last month, Congress lowered the prices for coverage and allowed farmers to cover more of their milk production. They also increased the program's responsiveness to monthly milk prices. Lawmakers even reopened the sign-up for 2018. Hoping more farmers would buy in now that problems were fixed. Stevenson says he thinks the program is worth taking a second look at, especially because Congress is unlikely to make any other changes to the program as they head into farm bill discussions. Stevenson says dairy has been a sticking point in previous farm bills, which is probably the reason lawmakers made changes to MPP outside of the legislation.
I think Congress feels like we've taken care of dairy now.
The problem is, Eric says a lot of farmers aren't ready to dive back into a program that didn't work.
MPP is kind of like a ship that's left port, and then they're trying to get the word out that they're going to come back and see if there's any more passengers, but I don't think there's going to be many at port side wanting to get on.
He says he's not opposed to the idea of MPP, but after 3 years of low prices and no sign of a price rally this year, he's not ready to spend what little profit he's making on insurance that may or may not help him. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.